Jaspreet Boparai and Don Nicholson with Greenwashed on RCR, Reality Check Radio.
Welcome back to Greenwashed. You're with Don and Jaspreet. Good to have you all. Now, we have been listening recently, not listening, I should add, reading about a couple of news articles about the huts, the Selwyn huts, which are a small community around Lake Ellesmere. And they've been in the news recently. They got a sort of a deadline by the council, the Selwyn District Council, in March and April of this year, telling the residents that they have till 2039 or around that time to finally vacate their huts. The recent council meeting just last week has given the community a reprieve now, and they have been told that the council is going back to the drawing board, is going to consult and engage with the community, and who knows where things may lead to from there. But for those of you who might not be aware of what's been happening here, here's a bit of a backstory. Now, the Selwyn Huts in Canterbury, there's always been a community there since 1895. There have been generations of Kiwis living here, four or five generations in some cases. And at this point, there is about 100 odd people who live there. And since 1987, this land has been administered by the Selwyn District Council. The hut owners, though, have been granted licenses continuously for over a century now. These licenses to stay, to inhabit, occupy these huts have been usually renewed on a five-yearly basis with a further provision for renewal. The licenses, to be absolutely correct, have only provided for occupation still now for about 183 days in a year, but they have always been renewed without any indication of, you know, whether that condition is being checked is strictly, and there's never been an indication that this renewal would ever stop until now. And in 2019, early 2019, with less than a year left on their licenses, there were rumblings that it might not be renewed. And residents were, so this is nearly 5 years ago, residents were sort of caught in the lurch, not knowing how long they have to stay in their huts. The council at that point confirmed that if the hut owners' licenses were not renewed, there'd be no compensation. And it would be up to the folks living at these Selwyn huts to negotiate life after they were evicted from these. There's been a lot of water under the bridge over the last 5 years. But one thing that I have seen and that's happened is after more than a century of being allowed to live there, council's paperwork now speaks about a finite term. And I see a whole list of reasons now being given to people there, including one of which is Dawn and my favorite, climate change. But that's just one. About people saying why they need to move and they need to move urgently. To talk more about this issue here today, Don and I are very glad to welcome Councillor Elizabeth Munt from the Selwyn District Council. The council just last week, as I mentioned earlier, has voted to go back and consult, engage with the community. So Don and I are keen to hear more. Elizabeth, the floor is all yours. Welcome.
Thank you very much. I just want to put a disclaimer in here first up, that even though I am an elected official and a councillor, I'm here speaking as someone who represents my community. I'm not speaking here with the council's wider views, because I may at some point say something which is more of a personal viewpoint rather than the council's
Absolutely.
Take on this. Far away.
So
yeah, so look, I'm just looking at Lake Ellesmere. It's a fantastic, I've been around Lake Ellesmere. I've farmed not far away from there for a few years in Irwell. I know the area quite well. It's a really impressive lake, and I understand why people want it looked after. At the southern end, you've got the Talmutu exit sort of point where it sometimes goes to the sea. And of course, where Jaspreet and I live, we have the Waituna Lagoon, which has similar issues about opening to the sea and the control mechanisms for that. All held with the council and I think the Department of Conservation. And you go along the sea coast and you go to Birdlings Flat. And I see there's an airport there and a rocket launching pad there. And it's called Tawhaki, I think it's called, Tawhaki. And on the turning around sort of the northeastern corner, I suppose, you get around to the Birdlings Flats community. and over to Green Park and round further to the Selwyn Huts, the lower Selwyn Huts and the upper Selwyn, or the yeah, the upper Selwyn Huts, and round you go, and you probably hit Leeston if you go right round. So look, it's a fantastic farming area. It's obviously a fantastic recreation area. What's the upshot here? What's the reason for these communities now being under the pump so badly?
Yeah, actually, Don, that's really one of the questions that the community have constantly come back to council saying, what is the why? What is the sudden? So the council had a meeting late last year, and they invited the community along. And the community thought it was an update on the sewerage pipe. So this community was have been in a bit of a battle for many, many years because they haven't had a serious wastewater treatment system that's been sort of up to code. So they've had something that was compliant many years ago, but they needed to bring that up to compliance. And Ecam was putting a bit of pressure on the council about this. So the community felt that this was sort of the reason that the council may have been saying, you know, they voted on, I think it was back in 2019. The council voted that this was going to be a finite term for this community because there was no wastewater system. And so therefore, they'll need to go eventually. And that was the progression and the decision back then. However, over that time, the council's been toying with, and in recent times, having to redo the Leeston network. And so they've brought that out where there's actually a sewer line right now being built to the community so that the community will be on the septic and in the surrounding areas. The community now feel that that's resolved this issue. So anyway, they turn up to this public meeting expecting to get an update about the sewerage pipe network. And lo and behold, they get completely, the meeting turns into something else. It's actually the mayor and the new CEO saying, sorry, it's a finite term, even though you're getting the sewerage pipe now. We're actually going to go and bring this to council in a couple of weeks, and they're going to go and vote on this. And the council will determine whether, you know, how long you stay. It's not a case of can you stay permanently, it's how long. And I just want to raise something quickly that you mentioned before, Jaspreet. You said that it was only for 100 and something days
a year. 183 days in a year.
Yeah, so that was back when it was fishing huts and it was a little bit of a recreational reserve. But because of the earthquakes in Christchurch, and also because the council had to, it was a nightmare for them to go around employing staff to go knocking on the doors
to police it,
counting and policing who's there for how many days. So the council sort of said, well, we've had this earthquake, we don't want to fund the policing of that, so we just allow permanent residency. So the council actually granted that permanent residency, and so that's altered, that's sort of taken that ticket out, even though the council sort of bantered around that these houses weren't built for permanency. I understand that. But at the same time, we're facing a homelessness crisis in the districts, and it's unseen. And the reason is because the councils are policing the reserves at the moment and moving on people that are living in caravans and in vans and in cars. And so they can only stay on one of our camping reserves during the summer for no more than 3 weeks, I believe, or 20-something days. And then those people get moved on by the warden. And so that's where we've now got this issue where it's getting, it's pushing the homelessness further and further into the further more remote rural districts. And those people are using the reserve toilets, the public toilets and the rubbish bins. And that's part of their survival. But council was not fully aware of the extent of the homelessness issue. And I feel that the government isn't even really fully aware because nobody's seeing that and watching what that is. And so while we've got these people living in houses that might not be up to current code or current standard, they've got a home. They've got a roof over their head. They've got somewhere to live. We've got a housing crisis of 25,000 people in New Zealand are on a waiting list for a home.
To explain to people, because you know we use the term huts, these are not huts, are they? They are not like a dock hut in the middle of nowhere where there's just one odd bunk or something. These are houses now.
Yeah. So actually, the interesting thing is they've actually, the community is now embracing, and they have been for a while, but now they're really pushing with that, the heritage status of these. There's a huge variety that's down there. So the earliest ones are sort of 1880s, and some of them were shepherds' huts that were brought on that have been repurposed and added additions to make them into little huts. So they might be a one or a two bedroom, mostly one bedroom sort of place. So it's fine for, you know, small families for the two bedrooms, or one for a couple or a widow or that sort of thing. And so these places, they're very diverse in nature. It's not the cookie cutter of today's subdivisions. And you've got these amazing heritage pieces. And I was saying earlier, there was some craftsmen that came across in the early days. And, you know, from the 1920s and 30s, when it was the arts and crafts style, which is the beautiful lead lighting, the stained glass windows, that kind of William Morris style of building, beautiful Rimu mantelpieces. There's actually some gorgeous huts down there. They had the community had an open day recently, and I attended and had a look. You wouldn't believe it. I mean, looking on the outside, it's just a cute little house. But you go inside, and these are museum pieces. They're all original, and it's got these amazing ornate craftsmanship, arts and crafts styles, and the early shepherds' huts and things. And not every house is immaculate, but the ones that are absolutely a testament to real love and heritage.
Yeah, and you know, that's no different from being in town. I could be living in a certain house, which is, say, really flash and new build, and you'd be next to a, you know, something in an art deco sort of way past its prime. That's no different. And now, going back to Lake Ellesmere, and their Maori name for this is Te Waihora. I see both of these, you know, used interpeppered between various council documents. Now, this lake, looking at Christchurch City Council's website, it is co-governed, right? And it's been co-governed for over a decade now, because the website talks of the Te Waihora co-governance partners have celebrated a decade of successful restoration activity in and around Te Waihora / Lake Ellesmere with the launch of a new website, which plays an important role in telling the full story of the Taonga on a doorstep, says co-chair Liz Brown from Naitahu and Jenny Hewley in Wamet, Canterbury. So, and you also do have reps from Naitahu sitting around your council table. And I may have heard, listening through your council meetings, because I know the representatives around your council table, they have speaking rights, but not voting rights. Let's make that very clear to our listeners. And the person there has spoken of the fact that Naitahu would like most of the settlements, most of the huts, accommodation, anything around the lake removed.
Yes. So she wasn't speaking from her own heart, but she was speaking as a Naitahu representative. Now, she's ascertained that in the previous, the most recent council meeting, that it's not the local Runanga, which is the local people from the local marae. It's not them who've made this statement or this claim. It's the larger Naitahu. I don't know whether it's the corporate Naitahu or the, whatever we call it, the bigger Naitahu, the heads of Naitahu, who've said. And so the original statement that she made earlier this year was in June 2024, Naitahu wants all of the lakeside communities to be gone. Now, at the moment, the Upper Selwyn huts, the Lower Selwyn huts, and the Green Park huts, they're all on leased land, but they're all leased by different. So we've got the Selwyn District Council administers the leases on behalf of the Crown for the Upper Selwyn huts. The Lower Selwyn huts, they are right on the edge of the estuary. They are administered by Department of Conservation. Mm-hmm. And then the Green Park huts are now on Naitahu land, because that was originally Crown land, but it was given back to Naitahu. Now, the irony in that, even though we're not really speaking too much about that community, the irony in that is that one of the main members and the main people who live on that site and fish, which is what Naitahu really want people to be doing, is to be, you know, collecting the maunga kai, which is collecting the food from that area. This guy lives and breathes the very essence of what Naitahu want the lake for. And yet he's one of the people getting evicted from his home that he's lived there most of his life since he was a little boy. He's getting evicted from that site, and he is one of Naitahu's elders. Whether they consider him an elder or not, he is an elder, and he is Naitahu, and he He was one of the main people who submitted, did the submission and proposed that the Crown give the land back to Ngāi Tahu. So it's really a very interesting
Gosh.
but very sad scenario.
What an irony. So the crown gives back the land to Ngāi Tahu, and now Ngāi Tahu's elders there are themselves being evicted. Don?
Well, there's a bit of tribalism involved in everything. No matter what tribe you're from, there will be factions within, and that's what we're seeing here by the sound of it. Don't know for sure, but sounds like something suspicious there. It's odd too to me. Just looking at the aerial pictures of that area, the farmland is right next to the Green Park huts. I do, as a farmer, I just worry about the future of farming in this region. There's so many people trying to turn the tap off and make sure it's harder to farm. This movement about the upper Salwyn huts, the lower Salwyn huts, the Green Park huts. I mean, no one's talking about the Birdlings Flat huts or township because that's on a different lake. I perhaps misrepresented that a little earlier. Or the Tawamutu Point sort of settlements. No one seems to be talking about them, but this is a slow creep that will, in time, if we're not careful, emanate further. It'll just spread further out into the community. The periphery of the lake will be under threat of no farming.
Yeah, absolutely right, Don. There's a few points to touch on there. The first thing I'll raise is you talked about Tawamutu Point. It's called Fisherman's Point. Now, the interesting thing about that is they're actually the most vulnerable of any future flooding slash climate change slash lake level rising, etc., of all of the communities. The reason that they are not being touched is because they're actually the in what we call I would call in-house Ngāi Tahu. So it's the Ngāi Tahu, that marae, one of the marae is on that site, and the people that live there are predominantly very well connected to the marae, mostly from what I understand. Now that the community that the communities that have been affected have raised the whole issue about how come they get to stay and we have to leave,
Sure.
and Ngāi Tahu's come back and said, well, we're going to look at actually addressing the climate change issues that we believe are going to affect all the other communities. We're going to use nature-based solutions, and we want to put a land bank in and nature-based solutions so that we can stay on this site. So everyone's sort of saying, well, why can you guys stay and have nature-based solutions and then the other communities can't? But they've also said, well, they want their sewerage networks and they want council to fund it. And so there's a real division, as you said. There's a fraction between the haves and the have-nots within Ngāi Tahu, and yeah, the communities are very, it's very divisive, and it's a real shame. It's very
And it is coming for everyone. It could be these people now, but I look at a global picture. If you look at Netherlands, they had farmers, pretty much anyone who was within what they call the Natura 2000 areas. And environment, we all live off the environment, whether we like to admit it or not. Every single thing, humanity, civilization, progress, it's all happened thanks to man exploiting nature, right? There has to be a balance, I agree. But at this point, environmentalism has been weaponized. We are seeing the same thing play out in every country. And even within New Zealand, we are seeing this happen here. I live not far from this particular beach community in Western Southland, in Te Tapiri, where suddenly it was said that you can no longer manage the sea as it was traditionally managed and has been done by artificial means, but that's what we have to do. Dawn lives not far from Waitūna wetlands, where again, because man has used nature, you manage it now. But what they rather want is the talk of pre-human habitation times, those sort of standards, and nobody can really truly comply.
You're absolutely right, and this is actually a really big thing. So my entire region, so I my ward is primarily a rural ward,
Right.
and if I love heritage, so I love when I moved to this area, I started reading about what happened, and it turned out that there was a huge flood in the late 1800s where people were living in cob cottages, and the lake came up and it flooded their cob cottages right up sort of halfway up their waist. They got in their horse and carts, packed their belongings, and most of them actually vacated, never came back, because it was just so detrimental, they lost everything. And I know that that history we have at this lake, we actually have a opening which is a man-made opening. So the lake has had to be drained, and there's historical evidence, well, according to the local historians, that the lake was actually getting opened by Māori. So when that Tamutu marae was set up, the Māori were actually going in there and scraping back the sandbank. So there's a wee sort of a big sandbank, I guess, that's between the ocean and the
And
lake.
the lake, yep.
And so as the waters drain down through our waterway channels and our rivers and things and our streams, they feed into that lake during the heavy months, and then you have to open it out to the ocean. So the ocean is lower than the lake height, and you open it
Right.
out and then it drains out. Now we have a contractor that is paid by the regional authorities to open that, and they're supposed to open it before a big flood comes to let it out. So we have had some flooding where, because Ngāi Tahu gets the final say on when it doesn't get opened, and we've had some flooding where Ngāi Tahu, apparently, I'm not 100% sure about this, Ngāi Tahu have said, well, we don't want it open too prematurely because we want the lake water to be as deep as possible for the health of the lake. But then if you don't open it in time before a storm comes and all the waterways from all the townships that are now built up, the suburban areas, all that water comes crashing through in a storm from their stormwater drains, and the lake's not open. Of course, it rises up and then it backflows up the rivers, and then we have flooding in our suburban areas, in our urban areas, and even some of the rural areas. So water just takes its weakest point, and there are many, but we were originally swamp land, and that's one of the things about our country. If you look at the topography of it, we're either on a hillside in which there's these high risks of landslides, and they're saying that the insurance rate is actually more claims for landslips and landslides than there are for flooding events in New Zealand. So we can't build on the hills because they're also a high fire and a high drought risk. We can't build on the lowlands because they're floodplains. They're either close, we're a long, narrow channel of a country, so we've got coastal routes all around us. So if we're worried about sea level rises, then we won't be building potentially within 2 kilometres of every coastline. So where do we go? There isn't any place that's particularly safe in New Zealand because everything originally had a flooding risk or could have a flooding risk now with the concreting and the way that we've managed
Yeah.
or mismanaged, building our societies.
Yeah, it's very, very well said. I can't disagree with any of that. We have been talking about the whole issue of the US at the Upper Selwyn Huts around Lake Ellesmere, where residents have been sort of put in a to and fro. You are evicted from your huts. No, you can stay for a while. And there's been this whole debate of how people who've been living in these huts for generations now need to move. The Selwyn District Council in March had passed a resolution that all people need who are around the area, which is called the Upper Selwyn Huts, need to leave by 2039. Now, a few months down the line, last week in July, the council reversed its stance and says and admitted that the consultation and engagement was not up to the mark. And they'd be going back to the drawing board and seeing what else is there. Now, one thing I did note that when the March decision was passed, it was made largely on the basis of climate change and rising sea levels, that we need to save these people from themselves, or the rising seas in this case, Elizabeth, and this has to be done. And now your council has gone back. I know here you're speaking on your private behalf. This is not going to be taken as the official stand of your Selwyn District Council, but it is not just climate change. Now I see everything from the water standards to the lease not being, the conditions of the lease not being met, inspections not happening, anything and everything. You're throwing the entire book at the residents.
Yeah, it's been a bit heartbreaking at my end because I really feel for this community. They've been there for a long time and they've done their best as a community to try and resolve. They've asked the council for the opportunity to speak with the council and work with the council. And initially, the council, as you've mentioned, weren't using their own significant engagement policy. So the council's policy stated that if something is deemed significantly high, and there are a list of criteria for what's deemed as high, then you have to engage with rather than just tell people what's happening. But the council actually deemed it as a medium level or a low level of significance, and therefore they could just sort of dictate to them and tell them. So the community have engaged with the lawyer and they have challenged the council on this. This is one of the points they've challenged. They've challenged all of the points. They've also challenged the fact that the council said that it was climate change rising sea level, because the data that was used was modelling done by an Aqualink report and it was using the IPCC 8.5. So I raised this in the original council meeting, stating that we needed to support the community and go back to the drawing board and not vote to evict them and to put these things in place. So we were giving them 15 years basically before they had to leave, but it was actually 5 years of rolling over a deed of license. So at any point, we had so many out clauses and so many very, very difficult hurdles for the community to hoops to jump through to stay there, that the council could have been evicting people for very simple things. So there was a long list of really hefty considerations that were in the deed of license, and some of them were ridiculous. That there were things where if you are not telling your neighbor to be quiet and their noise is upsetting another neighbor, then you'll be put on notice to be evicted. So there's sort of things like that where the community were, don't quote me, my words probably not true and accurate record, but along those lines. So there were a lot of things, and there's a number of clauses that have still been put in for the home. So the council is wanting to inspect the properties and check that they're up to the 1947 building code. The problem is we've got properties there from the 1880s. So they're looking at ventilation and how high the floor level is and things like that. But these properties aren't going to be able to meet that criteria. And does that mean then that the council can pink sticker the property? So that was one of the things that was raised in the council meeting just had, where the community member submitted to the council. She did an absolutely brilliant job. One of the councillors talked to her about, why do you not want us to inspect your properties? Mm-hmm. And she gave an example. She said just a few years ago, there was a chap in his house. The council came and pink stickered his house, which basically meant he couldn't live in it. It was, you know, deemed inhabitable. And the two reasons were, one was he had some electrical work that wasn't up to code, and he got that committed immediately. He called in an electrician. It was done in an afternoon. The other thing was the council said, you put a fire in and you haven't had a permit to have this fire installed. And the man insisted, no, I did. I went through the proper procedure. I have a consent, a paperwork, but I don't know where the paperwork is. So he fought for that. The council went back and said, oh, yes, we found the paperwork that was consented. So the community just don't have trust in the way that the council's operated in the past. So historically, the council haven't been supportive or solution focused, but much more compliance based and over-regulating. So that's one of the things, one of the concepts. But they've talked about, so the climate change, the ocean rising level, obviously, we've got this lake that I mentioned just before, where it gets let out regularly before a storm. If the lake isn't let out, then actually the flooding issue isn't just for this community. The flooding issue would be much wider than that. If we stopped opening that lake, half of my district probably would be, or just all of my district would be underwater that I represent. So the whole of Southbridge, Leeston townships, all the surrounding farmland, all the way around that lake for quite a significant number of kilometres, right? And then the waterways that can't flow out to the lake to drain off the townships would backlog back up. So the Lincoln Township would, again, half of that would be under flood.
Wow.
And that's significant because Lincoln University, if you look historically, was built on quite swamp land. It took a while before they got the original pioneers got the draining system set up, because it was so swampy. And that's a whole thing. Christchurch, a lot of the earthquake issues were because it is reclaimed swampland. And as I said before, what is New Zealand? We've got a large amount of floodplains. We've either got hills, mountains, floodplains, or coastal areas. So we have to be really realistic about what we've created to live on and how we're going to live there. So I don't think this new biodiversity movement, which has let everything return back to nature, let the rivers change course, because we've got braided rivers down in our districts in Canterbury, let the braided rivers determine where they want to flow. We haven't done that for the last goodness knows how many decades, where man has put in stop banks and channeled the river and said, sorry, braided rivers, we need you to flow here so we can build or farm here. Because that change is fine when you don't have occupation, but it's not actually conducive to continuing for humans to exist on the land. And that's one of the issues that we're facing.
So all of this is documented. I was looking at the agenda of your council that's publicly available on your website for the 24th of July meeting. And one of the references there that was put up was a master's thesis by a certain individual who is today a senior consents planner at one of our regional councils. And their thesis, which is now, I don't know how, is now supposedly a proof of everything, but the person mentioned in their thesis that the opening regime of Lake Ellesmere has always played a fundamental role in the biodiversity of the area, the migration of fish, managing water quality, and what you said just now, Elizabeth, protecting adjacent land from inundation. And the management of the lake's artificial opening has evolved significantly over the 20th century in a response to shift in environmental attitudes. And they say that historically, Lake Ellesmere, it used to be opened out to the sea by generations of Maori and Iwi, Whanahitahu, for decades prior to the arrival of Europeans, using flax sticks and shovels. And then once Europeans came in, the Canterbury Association was formed, and the leader then, Robert Godley, envisaged that Canterbury is going to be finding its fortune and pastoral agriculture, and here we are. And now what are we doing? Are we trying to revert back to those days where where this was agriculture, there was no agriculture there in Canterbury? Are we trying to revert back to that? Because as I keep saying, where do we draw the line? We don't want to live here. We don't want to have any sort of recreation here. We don't want to farm here. What are we pushing everyone back to the center cities? Will that make the Ponsonby Greenies happy then?
Yeah, so the land use change, you had a really good term for that before, I've just forgotten it, but the land use changes, if we do allow that narrative to take form. We had Rod Carr come and speak to us within the last month, and he said that that those changes are imminent, and we're going to be changing the way we farm, and it's going to be indoor farming. And I'm thinking, my district, my region that I represent is literally the breadbasket of Selwyn. So the beautiful areas surrounding the lake are the best and most productive. And it's not just dairy farming, and it's not just sheep and beef. It's actually really diverse. So we've got a lot of cropping and a lot of horticulture there. It's a fantastic area. It really is the breadbasket of the region. And our regions, our agriculture props up our entire, not just our global, our national GDP, but our regional GDP. So Selwyn really profits heavily from the farmers. And when the farmers start to go down, they spend less in the district. And that's noticeable to us in the stats that we're receiving at the business end. And so it really, everything is really, at the moment, fundamentally propped up by the farming community. And we can say things like, oh, well, we'll just invest more in engineering or this or that. But at the end of the day, money goes around in a circular motion, and people buy what they need, and everybody needs food, but nobody always needs IT. IT doesn't feed us. Engineering isn't going to feed us unless it's an agricultural-based engineering firm. So food is our primary, should be of primary importance, and food security is something that I campaigned on and I'm very strongly advocating for in council. I'm very concerned New Zealand doesn't have a strong enough focus on food security. We talk about agritech, but as Rod Carr mentioned, you know, if we're moving food indoors, and his reasoning was, you know, to prevent storms affecting it, etc., it might be fine for a few lettuces, but that's not going to feed all of us at the wide range of foods that we need. And you know, we need to make sure that we're realistic about this. I believe, having lived in Europe and all around the world, I believe that our farming practices are some of the best in the world. And do you want to speak a little bit about that, Don, what we mentioned earlier, about why we are? Because we're moving the cattle on, aren't we? We're not.
Well, we're doing, and in your region, having farmed in that region, I see how the farming is done, and the very best farms are doing the ultimate regenerative farming. They're doing strip grazing, mob stocking, moving on. It's fantastic, the way it holds the fertility and it adds to the fertility. But the area has just such a variety of land use, and long may that last. It's great. You used the word diversity, and it has got diversity. Massive potato growing down in the Southbridge region, I think, from memory. And just it was black currants in my neighborhood when I was around. So, look, all that aside, there's a problem here, big problem. They've already spooked the horses, you might say. I would imagine in the Upper Selwyn Huts, there will be no one that's able to raise a mortgage against their land now or their asset. There's no one who will get insurance. I could be wrong, but to me, the horses have been spooked, and intentional or not, the damage will be done on insurance and banking. How do you see that?
Yeah, no, you're right. So these people actually don't have mortgages. So what the nature of these places are is they're on leased land. So as I mentioned
Yes,
before,
yes.
predominantly Crown land. So they couldn't actually get mortgages. They had to buy with cash. So a lot of people have moved there after difficult circumstances. So a traumatic divorce, for example, where they've split their asset, they've only got half enough to buy a house. They can't afford to buy a house on their own as a single parent. And so they've been able to afford to invest in this little smaller house in the smaller place here because it's on leased land. So they're only primarily putting their money into the house. And there's other people where, for health reasons, variety of health reasons, they can't afford permanent work. And so they might be on a smaller income. And so this is all that they can sustain as well. So they don't have banking issues. Insurance, I imagine most of them would have insurance, maybe not all, but yes, it would could potentially make it difficult for insurance, or otherwise they pay really high premiums. But this is something that has come out with the Climate Adaptation Bill, and I watched as many of those submissions as I could, and I submitted myself in terms of the paperwork. I didn't get an oral submission this time, but I spoke very much to those feelings of the insurance retreat is actually a word. An insurance treat where you let the insurance companies determine where you do and don't live is actually very scary. Maybe there's a little bit of merit in some guidance from the insurance companies, but if the insurance companies are then relying on council LIM reports to feed that, then the councils, as we've seen here, can go using really bad science. And we've had that with our council, with our Aqualink report. I challenged the scientists that brought the Aqualink report to the table because they were using the IPCC 8.5 model. And I said, well, hang on a minute. 8.5 is such an extreme model that there's a group called Coastal Ratepayers United up in Kapiti. And they've challenged, they took that. So that group, that community-led group, took their own council to court and won because the council was using extreme methods 8.5. And I have an article here from Simon about Simon Court. And I believe he's an ACT MP. He said here, when councils go getting involved and start picking extreme values, and he's talking here about climate change
Modeling.
measures, modeling, it has massive impacts on flood risk projections and it skews the perceived viability. So if the insurance companies are relying on council's reports, but councils are doing sort of what some people consider pretty dodgy science, then it's a really unviable game, isn't it, for all? And he goes on and talks about this, and he said the sentiment is echoed by Canterbury University's Professor Dave Frame. And this guy was a lead author on the fifth and sixth assessment reports of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So Dave Frame is also backing up Simon Court and saying councils shouldn't be using the extreme modelling. And this is where it was raised by the community in this recent council meeting on Wednesday. And they said, you know,
But
it's not the go-to now to use that extreme measuring. So we need to take climate change out.
we're not Sorry to interrupt. We're not getting that message loud and clear from the Prime Minister, from the Deputy Prime Minister, from the Minister for Climate Change, for the Minister for the Environment, for the Minister for Local Government. Not one of them has been willing to tackle this. And that's a massive problem because clearly this RCP 8.5 is causing massive tension around your communities, not just in yours. And the overuse of it is... Well, I find it obnoxious when you read these documents.
Yeah. Yep. One of the things that I've found in council is even if this current government comes in and says, are we recommending that you guys don't do this anymore? What I've noted is actually, I could get a big rap on the knuckles for saying this, but the councils are determining whether they will or won't listen to the government, because the only time they have to listen to the government is once it's legislated.
Yes.
But if it's advised or recommended, they don't have to. And so they're picking and choosing and cherry picking what suits their personal agenda and their narrative at the time.
So that is
actually frightening. So even if those ministers and those government officials got up and said that, which obviously Simon Court did, so I imagine there's some others that have, and we just hasn't been public knowledge yet. Then we really need to see the legislation follow that. And that's where the Climate Change Adaptation Bill, some of us are really hoping that the science is a part of that, is that they really determine what they will and won't use. And it's so, so important that we get this right. It's not a bill and it's not an overarching policy for the governments that we can just sort of whip through and hope for the best. We've really got to direct. And the reason is some councils, not all, but some councils are so sort of, really determined to use worst case and impose that on their communities. It's quite astounding.
It is stunning. I look at this. Now, last week, Dawn and I, we spoke to Mark Cameron, and who has proposed a members' bill which is going to stop regional councils from taking climate change and emissions and all of those scenarios into making the decisions. I think if and when his members' bill gets picked out, it needs to be for everyone, every single territorial authority, not just regional councils. But Elizabeth, you know, we've spoken for a while today and we sort of need to bring this to a close. I want to point it out to our audiences, how outlandish are some of the suggestions and the modeling that's been put on your council papers. Now, it talks about sea level rise. So your council paper, this is for the 13th March 2024 public agenda. It says that in the last 60 years, sea levels have risen by 0.14 meters, right? Then it says if global emissions remain high, sea levels will rise by 2040. So another 15 years by 0.21 meters. So last 60 years, they rose by 0.14. But somehow in the next 15 years, your council envisions it will rise by 0.21. So a quarter of the time, but half as much more emissions. And then your council's paperwork says that by 2090, the sea levels will rise 0.67 meters. That is five times what we have seen in the last 60 years. Your council's paperwork says, but the next 60 years, it will be five times as much. And then it goes on to say sea levels are projected to rise by 0.9 of a meter by 2100 under RCP 8.5. The most pessimistic scenario, but envisions one of its assumptions are that coal use goes up 10 times. And then it says if sea levels continue rising, Lake Ellesmere will need to be opened more often or managed under a new operating range. If global emissions remain high without any change in lake management, lake levels are projected to rise again the same 0.67 meters. So this is outlandish. You are somehow, by some crystal ball, they are able to envision a five times greater increase in sea level rise in the next 60 years than in the previous 60. And if, say, even if it happens, their issue, they say, is they might have to change the operating parameters within, you know, if the lake reaches a certain level, that's when you open it. Well, to that, I just say that, man, we exploit nature. That's how we exist. If you thought tomorrow, whether you're a vegan, vegetarian, or a carnivore, that if you stop using nature, you can exist, you cannot, regardless of whether you consume a mung bean or a steak. And this is where we are at. They are pushing people into misery, the people who, in your case, came and spoke so eloquently at your council meeting. And for anyone who's interested in listening, I would suggest you go to Selwyn District Council's YouTube channel. Start listening from about minute 20, which is when the first public commentator started speaking. And this elderly gentleman, I couldn't quite see his face, Elizabeth, but he said, "I've been there 70 years and the huts are now drier than they were than I remember them as a child." Mm. Isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, there's two dates there, Jess. Maybe you can share that at the end and a link or something.
Yeah, we will.
People to have a look at. But yeah, if I can just speak to that. So I mentioned in my first one, my first submission, the first time round with council, and I warned the councils that we were opening ourselves up as a council for litigation to carry on with this because we weren't using our significant engagement policy and we weren't allowing the community to work with for solutions. And her and Nui District Council, I was speaking to the mayor last night, I was at an event with her, and she said they've won numbers of awards all around the country for their excellent way in which the council has communicated and worked with and been solutions focused for this community, which will one day be affected. And it's a long relationship. It's not a short term, right, sort of fear mongering, you've got till tomorrow, then you pack your bags and you're out. And they've won awards for that. And so that's been a progressive and flexible project. And she said, as people sell and move on and new people come in, they have to start the conversations again and bring some new people on up to speed. But they accept that. That's the human way to do this. What we've done, we've had to retract. And thankfully, this last Wednesday, our council voted to change and do a full 180 and start back on the drawing board. So rather than saying that everything is absolutely cemented, that they're going to have to leave and climate change is going to be affecting them in this near future, they've actually retracted. So that's brilliant. So we've made progress in that regards, I feel, as a council. But talking about the data, and, you know, I love history, so I won't call myself a historian, but I think that whenever you are looking at anything science-based, you've got to look at historical data. Future modelling, and everybody knows, anyone who's involved in science knows that modelling is just a bit theoretical. Modelling is never a guaranteed anything, and you should never rely, it's a tool, it should never be the one glove fits all scenario. And so you would just maybe incorporate a little bit of some modelling. But if we look at the IPCC range of modelling, they've given such a huge drastic range. And then if we look at the observations, so if we look at the historical data, the modelling that was started in 1918, we've now done 40 years of it. Their modelling back then was sort of on a hugely high trajectory following the 4.5 or the 8.5 model. But actually, we are only on the 2.6. Mm. So the actual observations, the historical data show that 2.6 hasn't changed. And yet, when we look at our CO2 production, that's significantly increased, particularly if we take into the amount of coal that China's burning. So China emits 30% of the world's global emissions, and yet they've probably not signed the Paris Accord, and they're sure as heck not focused in directly. What's New Zealand? We are 0.0877% of the world's CO2 emissions. You know, the reality is that if we look at the historical data, the trajectory doesn't match up. And we can safely say that with that historical evidence, there's not a tipping point. So Rod Carr came in to us in council and said, so far the modelling hasn't matched, but there will be a tipping point. Well, what is a tipping point? I mean, what encompasses a tipping point? We haven't hit a tipping point yet. We need our emissions through the ages have significantly skyrocketed. So you've got to ask the question, actually, like, I'm all for sustainable. I was the first councillor to be driving an EV. I got elected in driving my EV. I have an electric car. I have solar panels on my roof. I collect my rainwater. I don't spray my farm. I'm organic and sustainable and do everything as much as possible. I'm not a vegan because I actually believe that meat is a sustainable way of living. But I have a balanced, holistic and realistic viewpoint on how we can do this. Like, most of my clothes are secondhand, for example. I think that we need to encompass that. And as you said, we can't live without nature, right? So we have to use nature in the best way that we can, but we can do it better. And so the focus right now should be on pollution, real pollution, like plastics, petrochemical pollutions, rather than worrying about the methane and the CO2 stuff in the way that they are. It's been politicized. It's clearly not focusing. We're not focusing our efforts and our intentions on things that are actually going to make a real significant big change in the world.
And isn't that a good place to end, Jaspreet? Because we've been on this mantra for so long. It's good to have someone else tell the story. We're on this crusade basically to nowhere at the moment. It's just a nonsensical concept around this emissions profiling and what you must and must not do. It's doomed to fail, but it's going to be at great cost on the way through.
I'm waiting.
And your area, the Upper Selwyn Huts residents, and let alone other residents around Lake Ellesmere, they're going to feel the wrath of this very soon.
Yeah, look, I'm next to the university, so we hear a lot from different professors and people that are coming together and doing things. And we had a professor from the university, and I started asking questions, but the council said, oh, here's not the place. So I sent him about 12 questions. He has never replied to my questions. And he was talking about, let's turn all the farms, well, not all the farms, but we need 100,000 hectares of land for solar panels to feed the power for the region.
Yeah.
And so I asked questions, and things were like, will you be utilizing battery use? Because otherwise we're only going to have daytime power if we're not able to harness the power and collect the power. There are other ways to do this, obviously. I won't go into it here. But the full life cycle, if you have batteries, if you have solar panels, the full life cycle, including the carbon emissions, if you're really going to go down the carbon road, the carbon emissions of manufacturing those, in importing them here, the effect of the coal plants using them in China, that should all be factored in to your solar panels and that end cycle. And I while I drive an EV, I'm not the first person to tell everyone to get one, because will that car in its lifetime actually be more efficient by the time we've factored in the battery? Yep.
Absolutely. Battery. I am so glad to hear you talking so realistically, Elizabeth. And, you know, as Don said, it is all going to come to a downfall. And as I said, I'll repeat again, I will be waiting here to hopefully see the downfall of this agenda within my lifetime. And I'll be cheering it on. Thank you. Yes, Don?
Well, I've got one last thing. On the Kaitariti spit, which I called the Birdling Flat spit earlier in the interview, there is this rocket launching pad at the Tawhaki National Aerospace Centre. It was all news to me. I suggest there's a few rockets need to be launched from there.
Electric ones?
In a specific direction to make things get sorted, because, yeah, this nonsense is just holding communities to ransom. And look, Elizabeth, fantastic that you're sticking up for your community.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for your time today, Elizabeth. Really appreciate it. Have a good one.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Are you on the RCR mailing list? Never miss a beat of the news and hard-hitting stories you've come to know and love. Stay in the loop. Visit realitycheck.radio/email.